Ciao ragazzi, I'm Luke Gamrot and welcome in Diavolo Toscano, the show where I invite interesting people and speak about difficult topics. So, first, bravi for Monte Giovi, the place who hosts me and hosts us, the most incredible town in whole Tuscany. The second, bravi for Louder & Higher, the marketing agency company who help us with all producing that show. And the third, bravi for you guys, because you're watching that, because you subscribe that. And today I've got a big announcement, because my guest is Joey Giordano.
Ho ho! Wow, I hope I will be interesting, but I'm ready for whatever you have to offer.
We will see.
Let's see if I meet the challenge.
Who is Joey? He's one of the most well-known and the most talented painter in whole USA. So that's a big thing for me. He's from Baltimore and we've met here in Italy, in Tuscany.
Beautiful, beautiful.
So that's the place. Like, if you are thinking, what is Monte Giovi and why someone like us want to move here, that's the reason, because you live in a small city, in a beautiful landscape, and the most incredible thing is that you met right people. So the right people is Joey. So today I hope we will have a long interview about every interesting topic, what we can find. We are in Italy, so my first question is, what is the most annoying thing here in Tuscany for you, Joey?
You probably already know the answer.
But they don't know.
For me, the most annoying thing is how long it takes to get anything done. There is Italian time, which is forever. And then there is Monte Giovi time, which is beyond forever, into another twilight zone. So that when you're in Monte Giovi, you can never expect anything to happen when it's supposed to happen. Okay? It takes some miracle to make things happen.
Okay, because you're from DC, yeah? Like Baltimore is...
I'm from a city.
Yeah, from the city. So what is the biggest difference between the lifestyle here and living in that,
okay,
in a big city in,
okay,
the US?
I also want to put this in perspective. In terms of cities go, Baltimore is relatively slow pace.
Okay.
There is the fast pace of northern United States, Boston and New York. And I lived in New York for a long time. There is the slower pace in Baltimore, and then there is a snail's pace in the South. So the three regions of the United States have their own pace. The slowest pace in the South is fast pace in Italy.
Okay. No, certo.
It really is. It takes some getting used to. Of course, some people come here because they don't want to be rushed. We had a friend who, we have a residency in Italy. Her name was Maura Baldi, who we named the residency after. And Maura would always say, to be in a hurry is barbarian. And I know that there's truth to that, because when you're in a hurry and you become impatient, you don't see life for what it is. You have this expectation of life that your meter is different than the meter of life around you. And that's not a good thing. So the good thing about this area is, if you want to be patient and quiet and let time go by, and if you can make that adjustment, this is a great place for that, Monte Giovi.
Yeah, that's hard, I think, for Americans, because you've got this thing, like, you're in rush all the time.
Yeah.
You always think, like, of course, it's generalization, so sorry, because it's a little bit more stereotypical. But still, when, like, 2 days ago, we've met some friend from New York, and he just came, like, just arrived. And the first question to all table, what he asked was, if anybody finished their job for today, like, like, that's like some kind of lifestyle for you, that you're very into your work, your, like, it's like it's define your who you are from time to time. And here it's like you can see it's different. Like, people just trying to enjoy life and what they are doing, like professionally, of course, it's important, but it's not dominate the life.
That's true. And that's what many people come here for, including myself. I've never been able to make a full adjustment. So, but yes, this is the beauty of, part of the beauty of Italy is taking in the landscape, taking in the air, taking in the pace, sitting down for long dinners, not being rushed to go out. Like in the United States, at dinner, you'll have three or four people at a table between, say, 6:30 and 11 o'clock. One table will have three or four families in and out. In Italy, it's only one family, one table at a time all night. So that's kind of a measurement of the pace, a time pace, how it works.
Yeah, that was difficult for me also, because I also lived in a big city in Poland, Katowice, and that was always like when we had a lunch, that was like a quick lunch, okay, we can eat and go. Here, if you are meaning to meet people at the dinner, there is not just a dinner, that's the right party. Like, that's a party because we've met and we spend like 4 hours together and have a great conversation between the main courses. And that's good. Like, I like that feeling. You choose that kind of life that you just skip from USA to Italy.
Yes.
To spend a couple of months here, then come back to Baltimore. You can make that compare between, for example, people there and people here. What's the biggest difference?
When you say people in a big term, people, I feel more comfortable when I'm in Italy in general than I am in Baltimore.
Why?
This is not for everybody, but there is a lot of violence in the United States. A lot of violent people, a lot of violence, a lot of crime, muggings, physical crime. You're always watch your back. When I come to Italy, all that tension of having to always be watching your back. It's an expression that we use, watching your back, as though somebody's gonna come and mug you. All that goes away. And then I forget about that tension. And then as soon as I arrive back in the States, it all comes back. It comes back not just because of the memory of it being coming back to me, but what I'm seeing in the behavior of the people. There are people that you never know what's going to happen, and you have to navigate your way through a lot of things by changing your personality, your behavior, becoming someone that you don't necessarily want to be. But here I feel, when it comes to that, that I feel extremely comfortable. I think man or woman can feel very comfortable walking at any time, anywhere they want to go, and nothing's going to happen to them. And the crime that does happen is almost always minor, very, very, very little violence. For instance, a statistic that I read years ago, 5 weeks in New York City, there's more violent crime than in an entire year in Italy. And New York City is just one city.
Yeah.
You got Los Angeles, Baltimore. It's just exponentially violent. The other thing is, there has never been a murder ever in a school in Italy. In the United States, it's almost a regular occurrence, mass murders. So it shows you a big difference of how you might feel in one city or the other. I'm sounding very negative about the United States. I love Baltimore. I love my life in Baltimore, but it's all where you are at any particular time, it all depends on. So
all of us love Baltimore because of The Wire, the TV series. But the TV series was like, when I hear about Baltimore, I just see what I saw there. So
there are places that you do not want. You're in your car, you want all the windows up, the doors locked. If you wind up in that neighborhood by accident, what happens sometimes, you make the wrong turn and all of a sudden all the door fronts are boarded up, the windows are boarded up, half the homes are, there's only a person, a house every so many houses where there's someone living in, the streets are filled with trash. You hope to get out of that as soon as possible. I don't feel that squalor and that kind of environment here at all. I'm sure maybe there are parts of Italy, there must be. Most cities have it. I know where I want to be, where I want to go in Baltimore. I'm very conscious about that.
If there is some parallel to current situation in the USA, for example, because I know that there are two fighting camps or two fighting groups of people who just don't want to have any contact with the other one, and they just hate each other, and they of course disagree, but that is something above the disagree. That's some so big polarization between them. Is there any option to find the possible, I don't know, get out from that loop?
If anybody has an opportunity to, like, say, like, you write a Facebook post, so it's your post, and then people react to it. So in that case, being the generator of the post, I feel like I can insert myself in certain ways to make sure that people behave civilly to my post, and if the people are disagreeing, to insist that they did not attack each other personally, but stay on message about what they agree or what they disagree with. So I think if people try to do that and listen to each other, no matter what the disagreement is, it starts to heal the divide. It shows a certain respect, at least for each other's opinions, no matter whether you agree or disagree with. Yeah. So that's one way.
Okay.
Personally, you can do that.
But in the big picture, for example?
In the big picture, it takes leadership from the top.
Okay.
Each country's leader and all the other leaders from the local level all the way up to the national level have an obligation to unite the people for the common good.
What is a common good? I think that there is a lot of interpretation of common good.
You're right. You're right.
Who has got the right to define what is a common good?
That's a good question. And I think about that all the time, because I use the word common good a lot. I look at it this way. If there are people who need your help, do you decide that you're going to help them or you're going to let them suffer? If you make a decision to help them, that's working for the common good. If you allow them to suffer, that's more or less on you and on your own conscience. But if we all try to be generous with each other and respect each other and work towards the betterment and prosperity of each other's health and welfare, then I think that's working for the common good. But in the United States, with the two political systems, they've divided each other. One political system believes to have a certain amount of socialism inserted in the capitalistic system that keeps the capitalism from going too far. Okay. To the point where it turns into pure laissez-faire selfishness. And there is no compassion, no generosity, because some people just don't understand that concept. They have no sympathy for others, and they're all about what they can get. The other political party has the socialist concepts that say, okay, we should have insurance for all people after a certain age because they're no longer earning a living, blah, blah, blah. So there are two political divides.
I think, that's like one example of the divides. You've got plenty of that, and the next election is coming.
Yes.
So, what is your prediction of that?
My prediction of the next election is that if there's a couple possibilities, you have to figure out the possibilities. Yeah. Of what's going on. Right now, on one party, the leader of the party is in terrible trouble. He has 90-something charges of criminality against him, criminal felony charges.
You are talking about great Donald Trump. The greatest, of course, in his own mind.
In his own mind. He actually calls himself the chosen one.
The chosen one. Yeah, I hear that.
And he also calls himself the stable genius. This is how he refers to himself. But anyway.
Very big self-esteem, for sure.
It's all talk, because in reality, he's a whiner. He's a crybaby. He's constantly blaming others for his own faults. And he's constantly looking for sympathy. He's pathetic.
Sympathy or maybe the attention. Attention, because, you know, he's feeding the hate, yeah, like the same, on the same level like sympathy.
Oh, he's just such a crybaby.
You know, but Joe, to be honest, we could, like people could laugh of him on the beginning. And I remember when I was watching some news before he started to be in president, the time when he announced that he are going to be the next candidate for the like president office, everybody laughed like shit, like that was crazy. I saw the reaction of the people, like public people, that was like a total joke. But after that, it stopped to be a joke. Like
it did.
Yeah. So if we constantly do that thing, like be laugh of that, like you are a joke, you are nothing. But to be honest, he's not nothing. There are like, I don't know how many millions of Americans who believes him, who want to elect him. And that leads me to the main question, because when we decrease his position, who is the Donald Trump? We like said to, we saying to that people who elected him and vote for him that you are trash like him, and that's not leading us to anywhere, like just to crash with them. And we couldn't make a civil like conversation and debate when we speak on that language. Like I think so.
Well, one of the things that has happened in the United States is, for a great part, is that we have lost civility. And civility comes from the people who have to live together in a city. Mm-hmm. Civility and city is related. It's different. So if you live by yourself in the far away from everybody, you can leave your music on as loud as you want. Put as much smoke in the air as you want. You're not bothering anybody right next to you.
Walking around naked, I'm doing that.
Yeah. You can do what you want. But if you're living in a city with people in close proximity, it takes sensitivity to each other to coexist.
Yeah.
When you lose that sensitivity to each other, you're no longer behaving in a civil way. The whole idea of being in a city is not what people think. Oh, you're living in a city, you can do it. No, it's the opposite. When you live in a city, you must respect your neighbors. You must make certain personal sacrifices for the good of the welfare of everybody. And then you can say hello to your neighbor, and no matter what their politics are, you're respecting each other. But if you have a neighbor that wants to play their music all loud all night long, that's not being civil. And part of the problem of that is the United States, we stopped teaching civics years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was a time when you taught civics in school, you understood the whole history of civics going back to the Greeks. You could learn that in school and you understood why we should behave in certain ways. For some reason, the schools don't teach it anymore.
You spend a lot of time on this earth, you know, you remember a lot of the previous president of USA. Yeah. What's changed from that time when the people in USA, you always had a big trouble, you know, there were fight for the black people rights, the fight for the women rights before that, a lot of problems, you know, but you manage that and you could be, like, sorry to say it, the greatest country in the world, but you've been that, you know, on that position for many, many years. And something's changed, but what? From your perspective, like, if you...
From my perspective, there's always going to be opposites. There's always going to be variations of opinions of how, yeah, things should be done. Two things that drive people apart is how to run the economy and whether or not the state should have anything to do with the church. Two big powers. Economic power and the power of people thinking that they can control the morals of others. In the United States, we set certain goals with the founders and that were higher than the goals they kept for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Like
they had slaves. For most part, they never got rid of their slaves.
Hamilton did possess any slaves.
Very few did that. Yeah. Some did. But anyway, at least they said, do what I ask. Don't necessarily do what I do, but but do what I ask. So at least they set some kind of foundation to improve the relationships of human beings between each other and respect. And that has been a driving goal. And there another driving goal has been the idea of liberty in a sort of the French sense of the word of liberty. Okay. But the idea of liberty, and that is the welcoming of all people, give me your poor, your abused. We had this great noble idea that the French actually gave us that Statue of Liberty to put in the harbor for welcoming foreign people who had been oppressed or whatever, poverty, whatever. That was a big visual icon for most Americans that the Americans believed in. What happens is that each immigrant group that came to the United States faced prejudice. And unfortunately, as time went on and they got their piece of the apple pie, the American pie, they became unwilling to share. And so they became part of the oppressor.
Okay.
Virtually every ethnic group that gets to a certain place, they get to the place where they become the oppressor and then don't want the Muslims to come in, don't want the Jews to come in, don't want whoever, they become the oppressor. So what happens is the leaders, supposed spiritual leaders and economic powerhouses start playing a part with that because they can get the vote. And once they play a part in it, they start putting a wedge. And the wedge has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, for instance, the former president, who was not at all a religious person, he got influenced to carry on from the Christian fundamentalists a Christian philosophy that he had never practiced. They made a deal. They're incredibly powerful in the United States. You know, among the most powerful, the Christian fundamentalists are vote in a block. And they're fanatical. So this continued to drive the wedge. The president did this in order to get the vote to become president. He got the support of very powerful right-wing economic groups, and he became president. Turns out that he was a terrible president. He split the country. He was slow to react with COVID. He did a lot of things that offended the middle-of-the-road people, and he lost his run for the election. But he set such a set of animosity in motion that it's going to take a long time to heal the wounds. And I don't know if the current president of the United States can do this. He's trying. He's a diplomatic person. I don't think anything's going to be settled in terms of that. And I don't think the United States is going to get on good grounds until that leadership that existed before is put in prison for the crimes, 93 crimes that he committed. Rape, treason, you know, trying to overthrow the government, hiding money, tax evasion, all these different things, trying to influence the election illegally. Once he's put in jail and his followers, the top leaders, are put in jail, I think that will calm things down.
Do you believe it? That's going to
happen?
Yes. Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I believe it's going to happen. I don't know how it cannot happen. It's so obvious. There's so much evidence, film evidence, recordings of calling the attorney, the lead person in Georgia, saying, you know, I only need so many votes.
Yeah.
You know,
I hear
that's bullying. It's a form of coercion that's illegal. I think he's going to go to jail.
Or he win next election.
No chance.
That sounds like when I hear that in so many ways before he won first time. You know, that was the same. Like, no chance to win for Trump.
But he'd lost the second time. He lost by 7 million votes.
3 million.
And he lost primarily because of the middle people. And more of the middle people have seen his show of how horrible he is.
Yeah.
He hasn't gained any votes. He will continue losing votes.
Okay.
I am very confident that he's not going to win the election. I hope that he's going to be in jail by that time.
I hope, like, Joey, for your own good, I hope that's going to be the truth, because that interview will get older in a bad way. You mentioned that Americans like to find the opponent, some group of people, and starting to fight with them. I remember, I'm not that old, like I'm 35. I remember all of that big wars in the world, there was always USA involved, and they were like enemies always, and USA fight for beautiful democracy. Now they just start like the society of America, like American people start looking the enemies inside, like inside the countries, like they started to fight each other, and politics just showing like pick that you know, differences and courage that differences and blow on that, like on the fire, and start getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And what I see, for example, on universities in USA, that's for the other side, like the woke movement and a lot of like leftish, but like on very hard way. Mm-hmm. They just, you know, cancel people, cancel art, cancel stuff. That's like the, you know, opposite side of the same coin.
Exactly.
And that's crazy.
That is absolutely crazy, and it drives me crazy. Personally, I'm totally against censorship. I can't say totally, because I'm opposed to hate talk. I'm opposed to inciting hatred. And I know the First Amendment is maybe a little ambiguous about that. The First Amendment is the freedom of speech. I want everything to be exposed for what it is. I'm against the tearing down of statues. I just feel like if these statues of Robert E. Lee, the general of this Confederacy, were up, they've been up for 100 years or whatever. I know they represented the opposite side of freedom. It was anti-slavery. They made heroes out of people who wanted to make people into slaves. But eventually those statues were going to become symbols of that horrible time. And they will remind people of how horrible these people were. The perspective of these images are going to shift, as they have shifted already. Mm-hmm. But they've shifted, and people now understand that Robert E. Lee was a terrible person in a certain kind of way. But all the reminders of Robert E. Lee are down. And we should never forget that we had a civil war. It shouldn't be something that was forgotten. So I'm totally against censorship. And I think going after people for the simplest of things that they said, and canceling them out is one of the worst parts in our history. So we've gone after both sides. Samuel Clemens, a great writer, wrote very important books that were open-minded books to showing that women should have a right to pursue their professions, showing that the black person was a sympathetic person to the sufferings of others, and that would help out people. He's been attacked. He uses the language that black people used in the time. Samuel Clemens used that language. He's been attacked as though he was insulting these people, but he wasn't. He was just using the vernacular
like a style,
of the time.
Like a style, like a narrative.
Yeah, supposedly liberal people, but they're now at the other end of the, you know, on the other end of this thing. It being ridiculous.
If we are thinking, like, try to find the way or answer why there are so many supporters for the, for example, Republican Party or stuff like that, guys, look at the other side. Like, it's the simplest way how to show the people, like, you know, maybe we are not the angels, maybe we did a lot of shit, but if we don't elect us, that's gonna happen. Like, you will be scared to say a word in public. Your children will be reading the writing books in the school and stuff like that. It's only when we are going extreme, like the extreme. What I want to say that extremes are always bad. Like always.
Right, right.
And I know why people like it. Like, I think I like. People are going on that path because they feel power. You can just say a word, or you can just point to some person and say he needs to be canceled because of one, three, four, you know. And I've got power. I feel like I mean something. And we can like vape big people, great people, because we can, because now there is narrative in the political correctness and stuff like that. And that's like a big thing also. Like that's crazy, because where is freedom of speech and American freedom there? Like I couldn't understand that, like how it's collaborate, like on the one side is a big thing, like all of that American freedom and freedom of speech and stuff like that, and the other thing is like to, you need to think like that, or you need to, you can't offend another person because something, because you say, I couldn't understand it. Like that's like something.
When it gets to the point also of violently attacking other people for what they say, that's also, I mean, it goes too far. I mean, I think it's okay to say, I disagree. We all have that right. I mean, we have the right to disagree with our government. Whenever the current president, although I'm in the same party, you know, I'm a Democrat, does something that I think doesn't match my values, my personal values, I have a right to disagree, and I disagree. And if his son, Hunter Biden, gets into trouble and it proves that it's wrong, put him away with Trump, put him in the same cell. I think we have to like be that way. We can't be afraid to express ourselves, but we can't also cancel each other out.
Yeah, I remember, I'm asking because I remember I don't remember the time, but that's a very close time to my parents and grandparents in Poland and in all that Soviet countries, that, you know, there was only one narrative. Like, and you couldn't say a word, because if you say, they could kill you. And of course, it's extreme. That was a totalitarianism. But
you know, I mean, it's almost true, but it was never like that. I think that was an image, a prevailing image of America, that had enough truth to it to open up dreams, you know, of what could be. It was never perfect. There is no perfect.
Yes, of course, never.
Never.
What was the most important pain for you?
Pain?
Yeah.
The most important pain?
What you did, what you created.
What I created, yeah, pain in,
yeah,
others?
Yeah. Like your painter, your paint. Like
my paint.
Yeah. Paint. Like
painting.
Yeah.
Oh, painting.
How to say pain? And then no pain, but like your biggest pain, we'll go there.
Okay.
I want to ask your most valuable or most important paint. What do you create? Painting. Because you are one of the greatest painters in USA. So
the most important painting for me, I don't think there's one. There's certain ideas that I pursued.
Okay.
Through a number of paintings.
Oh my God. Yeah. Please, okay, tell me something about
that. So, I mean, like for instance, my body of work has two directions. One is I'm out in nature, I'm in Italy right now, and I'm drawn to what I see.
Okay.
That's a reaction to my environment that I want to paint. So it's just a direct reaction to my environment. And at the same time, knowing the history, or great history of art, well, I know the many, many painters come to Italy and they're inspired by the light, the air, the landscape.
Yeah, that's easy. That's the easy one.
You have a challenge to find your own voice among millions or thousands of artists, many great artists who've come here. And can you find your own voice in this landscape that overwhelms you with this presence and beauty? If I'm in Italy, I'm attached. I want to paint that.
But I ask the most important for you.
Yeah, for me.
Yeah.
If I'm in France, I want to paint that. If I'm in Maine in the United States, I want to paint Maine. This is one of the things that I've always run through my art.
Okay.
On the other hand, I have art that I create that's not a reaction to what I'm seeing. It comes from an idea.
Okay. What kind of idea?
Could be many ideas. Like one idea was, I was very interested in very shallow envelope of space. You're getting into kind of like, okay, aesthetics, but so I wanted to make paintings that only had 2 inches of space between the beginning of the picture plane. Mm-hmm. Say, for instance, if an actor's on stage, there's a proscenium. So if you're in the front of the proscenium, surrounded by that rectangle, you're right up against what we call a picture plane, closest to the audience. Everything behind that creates a space within that stage. I was interested in putting something right at the front of the proscenium and then having a stage that was very narrow, very thin.
Okay.
So the stage did not go very far back. For instance, if it was in three dimension, I'd have a figure standing up, and there would be behind the figure a wall that was just 3 feet away.
But you mentioned about the series.
That's a series. Okay. So 8 or 9 years I painted that.
Okay. Very long time.
A very long time. Until I ran out. I did a big mural for Port Authority of New York, the trains that go between New York and New Jersey. I did the mural in Greenwich Village, a very big mural to enter the state. Did everything I could possibly do with that idea. The idea ran its course. The last paintings that I did, I didn't even have something in front of the wall. I was painting a brick wall. I only had light going across the wall. I took out even that. So it was just the brick wall with a shaft of light. And then that was it. It was a perfect conclusion of 9 years of painting.
That's the stupidest question in the world. But what does it mean for you to be an artist? And I'm just try to explain a little bit more, because there are plenty of young people, plenty of older people also, but could try to express themselves. But where is the difference between being an artist and just having a good hobby?
Okay. Can I just say a couple other important things when you ask me about my painting? I've had series that had ideas, and then probably the one painting been most important for me, and it's hard to say this because I'm working on something that's very important to me right now, but the one painting that I'll never finish maybe is that when I turned 60 years old, I wanted to make a painting of myself as I was at 60 years old, no flattery, all the faults in it. I worked very hard on that painting. It's just a little self-portrait this big. And then I took it home to my house. Did I tell you the story?
Please continue.
I took it home, and apparently I'd gone too far to the negative side of myself.
Okay.
And my wife,
Madeleine,
was very sensitive, could not live with it. She told me to get it out of the house.
Maybe she mentioned about you, like, you know, because you never know. There is a you and you on the portrait. You never know, Joey. Now.
So
what did you do?
I took it back to my studio. I painted on, and I said, okay, maybe I got it. I take it home, and she wasn't home.
Okay.
I'd look at it and take it back to my studio.
So I can see that there was a very important thing for you to take the paint to the home and see it in the home. Like, you putting some part of yourself to the environment, what is very important for you,
yeah,
very intimate.
Yes.
To see the how it's working with the that. Yeah.
By the way, there is a documentary on this. I think it's on YouTube, or there's another source made by Khalid Ali. He did a documentary on this. And you could see the stages of this.
Okay.
Not up to the most current, because he finished it a few years ago.
Do you think that she's still seeing that thing in you, like what you show her on the painting? What she saw on that paint?
She saw the worst of me, my subconscious, maybe the anger in me. What, I don't know what she saw. She just said, get it out of here, and we couldn't talk about it. And she never likes to talk about it.
But you sneak the paint the house. Like,
I had to, because I had to see it outside of my studio.
Okay.
And I had to see it in my house. But to finish the story, I'll make it shorter, is that I've been painting this painting. I'm 80 years old now, for 20 years. So I have 100 paintings on top of one another.
Okay.
Sometimes they do more than 1 year. Sometimes they can do 5 or 6 a year. Sometimes it takes me 1 year to do a painting. Sometimes they do more. And I learned a lot, because when I was painting this painting, it no longer was just about that. I left out the part that I wanted to, get every bit of me in there. I just wanted to get enough of me in it that when I was painting, the painting in my eye winked at me.
Okay.
Kind of winked at me. Says, okay, you did enough.
Okay.
So when it winked at me, I had to listen. If I didn't listen to the painting when it winked at me and I put one more mark in it, the whole thing got screwed up. And I start realizing that sometimes the painting could be look like just a wall of mud. If that wall of mud at some point winked at me, I understood that there was something in that wall of gray mud that had more to do with me than just my physical appearance. And so I started having to make choices of how objective I wanted to be, or should I let myself be subjective and go for whatever subjective thoughts I was going for. Because I started thinking at that point that being subjective may be the way to get to universality, to not make a piece that speaks for what everybody else wants to see, but to speak to something that people through all time and places can understand what's going on within that picture plane, can understand not that they it has to be a realism. There's almost no realism in maybe 50 of them, but just understand that there's something in there that's captured in the paint that resonates of truth, of some kind of truth. For me, it's 100 paintings, but it's the most important in my life of anything I've done. So now the painting is very thick with paint. It's so difficult to even lay paint on it without it turning muddy. I have to paint very dry just to make a line because it's have big holes in the painting. And so that's been probably the most important for me as an artist.
And what does it mean to be an artist?
There's different ways to look at it. What does it mean to be an artist? Am I talking to...
No, I'm asking like 80 years old Joey Giordano,
yeah,
who changed his mind like every decades, I think. And now, after that years and years of working, what does it mean to you?
To me, being an artist is no different than brushing my teeth.
Okay. Why it's so simple?
When you're a child, and it happens with everybody, the first forms, some of the earliest forms of expression outside of crying or whatever, is to make marks. It's a seminal experience in life that every child does. If a child understands that a pencil can make a mark, or a crayon or whatever it is, they're going to make a mark. And they're fascinated by it. Whatever they understand about life, they understand that that is a statement of some sort that they created. Whatever that mark is, a simple mark, a little mark. That is proven, you know, through studies and studies and studies, everybody does it. And we even know that at certain ages, how that mark transforms itself. We know for one thing, if you give a child a piece of paper and a child only stays in the center of the piece of paper, that says something about the way they're relating to the world. That piece of paper is the world. If the child fills up every bit of that paper, they're filling up the world. They want to fill the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we understand that, what that means. That's one thing that we know.
Yeah.
All right, and you can see that with children when they're very, very young. Those kids that are filling up that page when they're 18 months old, they're filling up everything in life as they grow older. They want to be everywhere.
Yeah.
They want to explore the world around them. They don't want to be stuck in the middle. There's also ways as you grow that you perceive. There's a certain point in a child's growth that they see everything from an aerial perspective. So if you ask them to describe their home, you're gonna see a plan, like an aerial looking down this way, not this way, but this way. It's just fascinating, all the studies.
Okay, and how it's related to being an artist?
When you say artist, I mean visual artists, because
yes, of course,
we're all artists, right? We're all of us that create as a purpose in life. We're all artists, you know, there's no doubt about that. There's just visual artists, literary artists, kinetic artists. But anyway, a visual artist is someone who, when they're introduced to writing and the powers that be emphasize that writing is the primary sources of communication and that we must learn how to write to communicate explicitly, the visual artist is the one that never gives up making marks. So we continue to make marks when everybody else stops. We find it the closest way to express ideas. And at a certain point, abstractly, we might be a representational painter, but we understand abstract ideas that are very difficult to put in writing, unless you're a writer, a poet, or something like that. Then you can express abstract ideas. But at a certain point, we understand that our purpose in life is a little different than other people's purposes in lives, and that our existence would be miserable if we couldn't continue in that direction.
How to find the difference between a good artist and a bad artist? Is there something
good difference in a bad difference?
Yeah, yeah. Is there something like
I
that?
I think when you're involved in art, really involved in art in the deepest way, you have insights into other people's art. You may not like the aesthetics of other people, but you must recognize the ideas that come through, and you must be able to determine whether that art is honest or if it's contrived. That's the difference. And for most part, it's pretty clear. If artists are not being honest, the work doesn't look honest. If it's contrived, you can see it's contrived. If you can see it's a good idea in the work, then you know that there's a good idea. Now, some people have good ideas but can't get it across. So how you get it across is another thing. It's how it resonates. If you put it on there and does it carry, one way you do know, Picasso used to do this, is he somehow or another had permission to take his work to the Louvre, and he would put his work next to a painting that made it into the Louvre, recognized as great art. And then he could feel how that stood the wall, if it held the wall next to another great piece. And so that's one of the beautiful things, important things that artists do, is that we have shows with each other. And we put our work up against each other. Okay. And we see how it holds next to each other. If it fails to hold next to another painting, it tells us we have to work harder.
Okay. So is the knowledge behind that? People forget about that. If you want to enjoy like classical music or good like hard novels with a lot of contextual things, you need to know that things. You need to how to listen the music, know how to interpret the music, how to interpret the things. For example, for paintings, we made a mistake, like we just came to some gallery, like abstract art gallery, and say, what the shit, like it's two shapes of something, it's shitty, I can do that. Like I hear that so many times. And because we forget that we need to put an effort to understand the language
exactly
of the visual art.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly. The audience also has a responsibility. We can't allow ourselves to live in ignorance. We must reach out and try to understand what we're seeing. And one of the ways you do it is just like you would read important novels, important books. You have to be literate in the form that you want to appreciate. You have to be literate in it. It's an obligation for the viewer to take themselves, contemplate what they're looking at, bring some knowledge with them from history, art history, whatever it is, to it.
Okay.
And it's just not that easy for anybody to go up and say, I can do this. It's not true. Anybody thinks they can write poetry that has never read poetry and doesn't understand the history of poetry, they're not going to write good poetry. I mean, it sounds elitist, but they're just not going to write good poetry. You have to have a passion for the form.
That's the one, I don't remember who wrote it. If you want to write one word, you need to read 100 books.
Exactly. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. For now, we're finishing the second part of our conversation.
And I'm going to show everybody this fantastic book that Lukas has collaborated
with Artur Dennis. So.
Okay, and this, and I don't read Polish, but what I will do is, well, get my translator, and I'm gonna go with my translator.
That never works for poetry. All,
I can hear it. Actually, the translator will speak to me the words, or either way, or it'll translate it into English for me.
Yeah, but to be honest, of course, the words and the sentences and the poems are from my side, but. Artur made one of the like tremendous work on that graphic design. Like he, Artur Dennis is one of the best graphic designers in Europe.
I'm so impressed.
And
I'm
of
so
course in Poland, one of the best.
Oh my God.
And he agreed to cooperate with me, and we prepared the poetry comic book, and it's like,
and it, what did it win? It
yeah,
has the Polish Graphic Design Awards laureate.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Grazie, and grazie for Artur. So, thank you, Joey, for the second part of the interview. Then we skip to the third part. So, ciao and see you guys.